ago, the Guardian, writing to the Baha'is in the West, and specifically to the Baha'is in North America, referred to the onset of a period of testing and opposition in the faith. And he said quite categorically that this would occur in the Western world as in the Eastern world. And we are well aware of this now for two reasons. One is the resurgence of persecution in the past decade in a physical form in the cradle of the faith, Iran. And secondly, the fact that the House of Justice has told us in recent years that the faith on a global scale has emerged from obscurity. And we all know from the seven stages of the growth of the faith described by the Guardian in Advent of Divine Justice and in God Passes By, that it goes through the stages, the first of which is obscurity, the second of which is persecution and repression. So for these and other reasons, we might well anticipate that the Baha'i community in the West as well as in the East must prepare itself for a period of testing. It is my considered view that that period of testing, of persecution, is not in the future in the West, but is here now. I say this because I read in the writings of the Guardian and his quoting of the statements of Abdu'l-Bahá, the references to the fact that in the Western world, this testing, this opposition, if you will, to the spread of the faith will be primarily mental rather than physical. And the one point I want to make to you tonight, the one point I hope to leave you with, is my belief, my conviction, if you will, that that period of mental testing is not some abstract nebulous thing in the future which will one day descend upon us in the Western world, but it is something that quietly, unexpectedly, and unobtrusively has come upon us now, and that we are now in the midst of this period of testing of which Abdu'l-Bahá spoke and which the Guardian foreshadowed. Why do I say this? I say this because my perception of Western society is that it has changed dramatically in recent years. The idealism of the 1960s and early 70s is absent. Remember the turbulence of the American scene of those years. The protest, the civil rights marches, the movement for the equality of the sexes, the anti-Vietnam protest, the ecology passions, all of those things, where are they now? That idealism, sometimes misguided, sometimes destructive, sometimes self-defeating, that idealism has gone. And the Western world has settled into a complacency, a self-centeredness, a self-absorption, an apathy about the condition of the larger society and the future of mankind, and an overall sense of short-sightedness about the direction of the future of the individual and of society. The Western world has changed, and my fear is that we are subject to a great and crucial period of testing at the present time because we face the real danger of becoming infected with these attitudes which have become accepted throughout the West. That period of idealism of the 60s, with all its turmoil, with all its passion, with all its turbulence, was a period in which the Baha'i community was also distinguished by its idealism, by its energy, by its passion and indeed its turbulence. Now in the late 1980s, when the society is distinguished by apathy, self-centeredness and short-sightedness, now is not the time for the Baha'is to become infected with those attitudes. If we do, we will have failed the test, the mental test of which Abdu'l-Bahá spoke and which the Guardian foreshadowed. I remember several years ago participating in a Baha'i discussion in which the believers present generally agreed that the mental tests were in many ways more dangerous than physical tests, because with the physical test you would know immediately who was doing it and what he or she was doing to you. With the mental test you wouldn't know until perhaps it was too late. And I remind you of this principle at this time because I fear that the Baha'i communities in the West, as well as in other parts of the world, are facing the challenge of these mental tests creeping up on them, sapping their energy, enervating them, rendering them apathetic, self-centered and short-sighted without their realizing it until it is too late. And it is for this reason that I lay emphasis upon this point, that I want as much as possible to ask that you remember this point. If you forget the rest of what I say, that you think about it, that you meditate on this, that you look in the writings to find either support or disproof of what I say, and that if you find it acceptable, you take whatever steps you feel appropriate to protect yourself against what I see to be a very virulent, very subtle, and very dangerous mental test. What can we do in the face of this test of a subtlety the like of which the faith has never before faced in its 145 years of history? How can we defend ourselves? How can we protect ourselves against such an insidious mental test? I believe we must begin by reaffirming and re-emphasizing as never before the spiritual basis of our religion, by returning to those spiritual disciplines which throughout recorded history have been the foundation of religion. The concept of prayer, transforming it far beyond the mere recitation of words. Fervent, devoted, yearning, beseeching, supplicating prayer. The refreshment and nourishment that we gain from the period of fasting each year. The sense of discipline required to read and meditate upon a portion of the creative word every day, day in, day out, week after week, month after month, year after year, the bringing of the human soul in contact with the creative word of the manifestation of God for this age. The concept of the spiritual element of sacrificial contribution to the fund, the vast effort and discipline, the pain and suffering inherent in character development, in reviving the moral, the ethical, the principles which underlie good character and the refinement of human conduct. I believe that in the face of this mental test, which is pervading us like a cloud, we must stand strong and make an even greater effort than ever before to cling even more deeply to these spiritual virtues, these spiritual disciplines and practices, which are the foundation of religion, be it the Christian religion, the Jewish religion, the Muslim, the Babi, the Baha'i religion. We must become and see ourselves not simply as people of a new social order, not simply as people aiming to bring about the oneness of the races and the equality of the sexes and the harmony of religion and science. We must see ourselves and nurture ourselves as Baha'is who are people of religion. People of religion who are primarily concerned with spiritual values, spiritual virtues, spiritual development, spiritual practices. I see this as a foundation of our traversing this very dangerous period in the evolution of the faith, when our communities, and particularly that in this country which is so much the engine of the Baha'i world, that traverse this period of dangerous and insidious mental tests. I recall, as many of you no doubt do, a story attributed to Abdul Baha of an occasion when an early pilgrim called Anis Rideout came to the presence of the Master and asked him what was the best way to develop oneself spiritually. And as I recall, the answer provided by Abdul Baha, it included some of the things I mentioned: prayer, meditation on the Holy Word, fasting, and the like. And it included one more thing, which I initially found very surprising and indeed somewhat repellent. Abdul Baha, if my memory serves me right, said to Anis Rideout that she should pray and meditate and read the holy writings. In addition, he said to her, if I recall, that it was important to meditate on the afterlife. And that was the part I found repellent. I said to myself, this is not like one of those religions which sort of gives you a spiritual bribery and says, do all these things so you'll be very comfortable after that, after you die. This is a religion which is concerned with creating the ever-advancing civilization, solving the social ills of mankind, creating a better world, not giving people spiritual bribes so they'll be nice and quiet and obedient and they'll have a good time in the next world. Now, as I've hopefully somewhat matured, or at least got older, maybe matured, I see a new dimension to what Abdul Baha has said in response to the question from this pilgrim. Because I see meditation on the afterlife not as something intrinsically morbid or depressing or negative, but rather as something positive and constructive and developmental. Not as something which would restrict the creativity and diversity of behavior, but as something which would enhance it. It is in this sense that I call your attention to what I understand to have been the admonition of Abdul Baha, that as an important element of our personal spiritual lives, we should meditate on the afterlife. And what do I understand from this? I understand that we should remain conscious as much as possible that we are in many ways living in the transit lounge. We are en route from one place to another, and the place we are going to is, we are told, a world with the potential for glory without end, for a degree of happiness and fulfillment far beyond
our comprehension. And we as believers, if we fix our goal on the fact that we are in transit, that we are pilgrims on our way to a distant horizon beyond the dimensions of the physical life, then we will steer our life aright. We will determine the appropriate priorities. We will avoid that horror one sometimes encounters of an elderly person in the evening of his or her life who feels a sense of emptiness, a sense of frustration, of disappointment and loss, and who even worse, does not know what it is they lost, what it is they did not achieve, what it is they did not find. It is in this sense that I see vast wisdom and vast practical guidance in the admonition of the Master that a part of our spiritual practice should be this wholesome, constructive, and developmental meditation on the afterlife. I want to take a few minutes before I conclude and address any questions you may wish to pose to touch upon one more element of my theme, and that is some of the more specific needs and opportunities that the Baha'i community faces at the present time. As I have said, I believe that we are at this very crucial time in history when we are called upon to be the agent whereby spirit is to be breathed into the clay body of mankind, being unified before our eyes in the turbulent events leading to the lesser peace. In that sense, there will never be a time like this. In the next century, it won't be like this. The lesser peace will have come into being. The body will have been born. Spirit will be flowing within it. Great tasks will remain: the development of mankind, its further spiritualization, the raising of great institutions, the construction of the world order of Baha'u'llah, the most great peace, the raising of the world civilization, and so on. But there will never be a time like this when we stand at the hinge of history, called upon to take responsibility to breathe spirit into this unified body being called into being in front of us. I think we can best perceive the significance of the period in which we live by examining the lessons of history, by looking to the early Christians as they contemplated the spiritual conquest of Rome and Asia Minor and North Africa and further regions. Did they realize that they were laying the foundation for 2,000 years of civilization? The early followers of Muhammad, when they came down from Medina to Mecca and made a pact and invited Muhammad to come back to transfer his residence to Medina, did they realize the significance of what they were doing? That from that favorable environment in Medina, the Muslim faith would take root, would flourish, would grow, would ultimately conquer Mecca and the Arabian subcontinent and then the whole of the Mediterranean and Middle Eastern world? Were they aware of that? I think not. And so it is, not simply in religious history, but in secular history. When the barons gathered around King John at Runnymede in 1215 and extracted from him the Magna Carta, did they realize the foundations of what they were laying for the future of civilized life for centuries to come? Did the formulators of the Declaration of Independence and the constructors of the Constitution of the United States, did they realize what future effect they would have not only on this nation but on the concepts of democracy throughout the world? I think not. And so it is today. Do we of this generation realize the significance of what we will do in the next 11 years for the whole course of the lesser peace, for the time